Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. Joining us today on the program is Amitav Ghosh. His new book is River of Smoke, and he's on book tour in Seattle. Welcome to the program, sir.
Thank you, Vic. It's a great pleasure to be with you. Thank you for having me.
I guess I'm just assuming you're on book tour.
I am on book tour, yes.
Okay. This book is the second book of a planned trilogy, is that correct?
Yes, I mean, a trilogy is about as far as I could think of when I started it, but it could be more than a trilogy, I'm not sure.
Oh, good. I'm glad to hear that.
Well, that's nice. Thank you.
I read Sea of Poppies, and I was just fascinated by that. But initially, as I began the book, I was a bit flummoxed because the language is so amazing, and it was so foreign and unknown to me. It took me a while to get into the rhythm of it. Tell us about the language in these books.
Well, you know, when I started writing this trilogy, I knew that I was going to be writing about a very, very multilingual world, you know, because the world of the Indian Ocean is a very multilingual place. There are, you know, really just an endless number of languages in that entire area. So, you know, obviously, writing in English as I do, you can't switch languages. But I did want to give everybody a sense. I wanted my readers to have a sense of how very multilingual this world is. And I wanted them also to be able to understand what that experience is like. Say, for example, for a young American like Zachary, I mean, he's stepping into a world where really so much of what he hears around him is difficult to understand. And I don't think that that really should be a problem, you know, because, you know, when I was a kid and I was reading American books, you know, half the words didn't make sense to me either. I mean, I didn't know what a hot dog was. I'd never seen a hot dog. But, you know, somehow one makes sense of it, doesn't one? I mean, you sort of figure it out that it's something to eat and it looks like that and, you know. So in that way, I think in a sense, one doesn't always need to know the absolutely transparent meaning of a word. In any case, I personally don't believe that words do actually have fixed and transparent meanings.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in, in and around the Indian subcontinent, you know, in India, in what is now Bangladesh, in what is now Sri Lanka. So in those parts of the subcontinent.
And how did you come up with the idea for these books?
Well, in a sense, what I was very interested in was, you know, the ways in which people have left India to travel abroad, you know, or to emigrate. And I guess it's partly because, you know, certain characters came to me. There was this character, Deepthi, who came to me very early, and I saw her as a sort of, you know, as a character who leaves India and who goes abroad into the world. So it began as a book about migration, if you like. It's a book about leaving. It's a book about. It began as a book about departures. So, you know, and then once I started looking into the background of these departures, it led me in many different directions. So, you know, you could say that, you know, one departure led to many departures.
Let's talk a little bit about the first book and then delve more deeply into the second one, since that's the one that you just published.
Certainly.
Sea of Poppies came out, what, 2 years ago?
Sea of Poppies came out 3 years ago, 2008.
Okay.
Yes.
That was one of my favorite books that year, and most of it takes place in India. And is it proper to say that opium is sort of the glue that holds it together?
Yes, absolutely. That happened in the writing of the book, actually, because, as I said, it began as a book about departures. Really, opium had no part in that. But what happened as I started sort of looking into the background of, India in the early 19th century, a very strange fact leapt out at me, which is that the first set of Indian migrants were all from this region in the deep interior of India, in this area between Patna and Banaras. And this in itself was a kind of puzzle, really. I mean, I sort of wondered why were people from so deep inside India leaving, because usually, of course, migrants are from coastal regions. And then I discovered, looking into the background, I discovered that this region was exactly the region where, at that point in time, the British East India Company was expanding its opium cultivation. And so, you know, the two themes sort of became very intimately connected, and I became more and more interested in the opium aspect of the book, and also, you know, the ways in which opium impacted on the lives of people. So it's been a sort of long quest, you know, and you're quite right to say that opium is the glue that holds both these books together.
It was fascinating for me to read about this, because I had read about the opium wars briefly in history classes, but it had never been anything that we had focused on. And the dynamic here, which you delve into even more deeply in the second book, is that India was producing all this opium, but they weren't really the market for it, were they?
No, the market was in China. What happened actually is this, that at a certain point, in the 19th century, the West faced, in relation to China, much the same issue that it faces today, which is that it had this huge balance of payments problem with China. The West wanted Chinese goods like tea and silk and porcelain and so on. And China didn't really have much use for Western goods. So there was this really a big problem for how to pay for Chinese goods. So it reached a point where, you know, the British really couldn't finance their trade with China anymore, and they decided that they had to sort of find some commodity that they could send into China. And there was a small trade in opium from India. And they decided that they would expand this. So they started expanding their opium cultivation in India. And very, very quickly, they managed to expand the market in China to the point where, in fact, the balance of trade situation was completely reversed. And China started losing a lot of money to the West.
Not to mention the inherent problem in all that addiction.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, they were facing really, they were the first society really in the world to face this situation of mass drug addiction. And, you know, they understood that quite early, and they tried to take measures throughout the 18th century. And then in the 19th century, when it became really a crisis, they decided that they would do their best to stop the opium trade entirely. And that was when Britain went to war against China to make sure that China continued to import opium, and this war was fought in the name of free trade, even though the British East India Company, which fought the war, was actually producing opium under a monopoly in Bengal. So, you know, It's ridden with all these strange ironies.
In case you've just tuned in, our guest is Amitav Ghosh, and his novel River of Smoke was recently published. It's the second book in a series. The first book was Sea of Poppies. And in that book, we learn a lot about opium production. There's actually an opium factory, and you introduce all these different characters. And I think if I had to pick a favorite character, and he's still my favorite in the second book, it would have to be Neil.
Ah, okay.
I love Neil because he's had such a tough time.
Yes, he's a very interesting character to me too, really. I must say, very, very compelling. I guess it's partly because he shares some of my interests, like language and literature and words and so on. But I based him actually on a historical character of sorts, which is that I was going through sort of like judicial records in Calcutta, and I came upon the case of this wealthy nobleman, a Raja, who lost all his money and was convicted of fraud and deported. So, you know, I started thinking about Neil at that point, and he's a very compelling character for me, too.
We have these ships, these amazing vessels, and the crews on these ships are fascinating to me, being a person who grew up in the American Midwest and has never experienced anything like this, even in books. And I love these characters that you call Lascars. Now, what were they?
Lascars were basically Asian sailors. The word Lascar probably was first used by the Portuguese to refer to, you know, Asian sailors. The Portuguese started hiring a lot of Asian sailors because, you know, they were away from their homes for such a long time, and they often needed the manpower. And, you know, it's a very strange word, Lascar, because it applies indifferently to all Asian sailors. You know, a Chinese sailor and a sailor from the Indian subcontinent, a sailor from East Africa, or an Arab, they would all be called Lascars. And these ships were incredibly sort of multicultural places. I mean, there would be people from, you know, dozens of different, you can't really call them countries because they weren't countries then, but from dozens of different ports, faraway places. But you say you haven't come across this before, but in fact, you know, you probably have. If you've read Moby Dick, you remember in chapter 40, there's this wonderful scene where he has all the people on the ship singing, you know, and that's when you discover that the people on this small, Nantucket sailing ship, actually, it's a kind of miniature universe with people from 40 different countries.
Did they call them Lascars in Melville?
Yes, Melville has one Lascar, yes.
Oh.
And the Lascar sings an ode to Brahma.
I'm starting, it's been years since I read that. I'm starting to remember that. Oh, my.
You know, it's a curious thing. Melville is one of the very few nautical writers. It's a very, very strange thing. I mean, you know, the corpus of Western nautical fiction is so large. And yet, there are very few descriptions of Lascars. One of the very few people to describe Alaska, to describe Lascars and their way of life, was actually Melville. I don't know if you've read his book Redburn.
No.
It's a memoir of his first voyage from to Liverpool, I think it was, from New York. And he has a wonderful description of Lascars in that book.
Speaking of research and books, I'm guessing that the amount of research you have to do for these books, just to even get the language down, it must be phenomenal.
Yes, it is a lot of, I mean, there is a lot of research, but, you know, I sort of enjoy the research, really. I mean, I love, you know, finding out stuff. So for me, the research is the fun part. But, you know, in the end, a novel is not about the research. I mean, no one reads a novel for the research. You know, people read the novel for the story or for the people, the characters, and that doesn't change, I think.
Well, sometimes you would have a turn of phrase, some of this colorful language, where I would just chuckle. And as I got into River of Smoke, I was delighted to realize you were still using this incredible language, yet I felt like I was understanding a lot of it. And then I get to a line, something like, quote, "cranny churning in a harborside creamery." Now, I just, I had to laugh. And readers will have to look that up, try to figure out what the heck that means. But just amazing. I love the language. Let's talk about the new book.
Yes.
This is a book that is a voyage, and it takes us to an exotic place and a very unusual place.
Yes. You mean Canton?
Yes.
Yes, Canton is actually almost one of the protagonists in this book. Canton is, of course, the city also known as Guangzhou in China. You know, Canton is a completely fascinating place, and so is Guangzhou. I mean, Guangzhou, which is Canton itself, is a completely fascinating place. And I'd never gone there before I started writing Sea of Poppies. But once I started writing Sea of Poppies, I went there and I went back many times. And I'm completely fascinated by the city, by the depth of its history, by the strange sorts of unions it created. You know, for centuries, Canton was the only city in China that was allowed to trade with the world, with the outside world. So it was the only city where foreigners could live. And they had to live on this one little enclave, which was a quarter of a mile long. And it was just this tiny strip of land on the Pearl River. And on this strip of land, they built these 13 factories. And it's an incredible thing that all the goods that came into the world from China, and, you know, well before the 19th century, the Chinese were exporting on an incredible scale. They were sending tea and porcelain and clocks and all sorts of manufactured goods and all sorts of paintings, you know, into the world. All of this came into the world through this one small enclave, which is the, you know, the foreign enclave in Canton. But an even more extraordinary aspect of it, to me at least, is that all the botanical stuff that came into the world from China came through this place as well. So, you know, Western botanists knew very early on that China had this incredible sort of horticultural tradition, that they'd been growing and developing all these flowering plants. So they, from Kew Gardens very early on, sent Sir Joseph Banks, who was the legendary curator of Kew Gardens, he sent collectors to live in Canton. And really, these collectors gathered so many of the commonest flowering plants in America today. If you can look out of your window onto a garden, you're almost certainly looking at a plant that came into the world through Canton. And I found that such an extraordinary thing.
And one of the threads in this book is the quest for an elusive flowering plant. Is this plant that they were looking for? Is it a member of the tea family?
Yes, it's a camellia, yes. And there are references to it in Chinese texts, and there were, you know, there are references to this kind of miraculous plant that perhaps was thought of as a cure for tuberculosis.
Let's talk about, is it Bahram?
Bahram, yes.
Bahram. He's really the central character in this new book, and he's a bit tragic, isn't he?
Well, he is. At the same time, he's a person who loves life and, you know, who's a great epicure. And he did become, for me, in many ways, the center of this book, because he's such an exuberant and larger-than-life character that he just completely took command of the book at a certain point. But he was, again, a very compelling character to me.
And he nearly drowns at the beginning during a storm. He nearly drowns inside the ship. And this is quite a tumultuous experience for him.
Yes, yes, but it's an experience that I'm sure many of these merchants went through because, you know, they kept their opium inside these holds. Often these ships ran into these terrible cyclones in the Bay of Bengal. The Bay of Bengal is notoriously sort of dangerous, especially the weather in certain seasons, especially September and so on. So, you know, it's just, I'm sure it was a situation that cropped up again and again when they found themselves, you know, in the hold of a ship where, you know, the crates of opium are breaking, the opium is mixed in with the bilge water, and it's sort of, you know, overwhelming them. And suddenly Bahram faces this situation where he's suddenly trying to salvage his cargo.
When we get to this enclave in Canton, and we get to meet these various traders. There are British merchants, Americans. Bahram is from India. And we have all these subplots and intrigues going on. There are the intrigues of Bahram's other family and his lost son and these relationships between traders. You have these dances where the men dance with each other, and there's something very, very electrical going on here.
Yes, well, you know, the foreign enclave, one of the things that made it very unusual was that only men were allowed to live there. So all these men who lived there had to leave their families behind, and many of them were, in fact, lifelong bachelors. And, you know, they had very sort of tender and intimate relationships with each other. You can see that in their letters. You can see that in the descriptions that we have of their relationships. And, you know, They did dance together. I mean, but that was a fairly common thing in the 19th century. Mm. I mean, you know, the 19th century, one of the most striking things about it is that there were so many situations of gender segregation. You know, I mean, sailors, for example, you know, they were sailing for like 2 or 3 years on, you know, on a single ship. And there are innumerable descriptions of sailors dancing with each other. And it was a fairly very, very common thing. I mean, I'm sure that, you know, there are many descriptions of cowboys and so on dancing with each other, too. It was not uncommon then at all. But it seems strange to us today, you know, because we think of the Victorians as being so, what can I say, so sort of buttoned up. But they weren't really. They were very exuberant people.
You, speaking of letters, have these wonderful letters that you've decided to include that were written to Paulette. And this gentleman who is writing them, he is a trip.
Yes, and he's based on a real character, actually. He's the son of George Chinnery, who was a very great painter. He was an English, Irish painter who, you know, studied at the Royal Academy in London. You know, he was a contemporary of Raeburn and Hoppner and so on. But he made his way eastwards. He was a very difficult and peculiar man, and he made his way first to Madras, then to Calcutta, where he had a huge success. But then he married very early in Dublin, and he was terrified of his wife, and his wife followed him to Calcutta. So then he fled still further to Macau, and from Macau to Canton. But while he was in Calcutta, he also had an Indian mistress. And with this Indian mistress, he had two sons. So one of these sons is Robin Chinnery. So Robin Chinnery goes to Canton. He's sort of very interested in finding out about Canton. And he becomes actually a sort of chronicler of Canton, writing these letters to his friend Paulette. And yes, it was wonderful to write these letters. But, you know, in many ways... The letters sort of came from the material, if you like, because so many of these traders who lived wrote wonderful letters, and I was reading all these wonderful letters. There's a particularly wonderful letter writer who's actually an American woman who lived in Macau in this period. Her name is Harriet Lowe. Her family was one of the major sort of trading families in Canton. Although she did actually sneak into Canton once, but women weren't allowed there, so she had to live in Macau. But she wrote these wonderful letters back to her family in Brooklyn, in fact. Mm. So, you know, the tone of them was very particular, and I guess that sort of influenced me. It's an interesting thing that Americans perhaps aren't really aware of the degree to which America was involved in the opium trade, and really... To me, one of the great surprises of writing this book was to discover really how closely the American elite was involved with the China trade and with the opium trade. For example, you know, one of the major traders in Canton was a man called Andrew Delano, and he was Franklin Delano Roosevelt's grandfather.
Ah.
I mean, in fact, that's where the family money came from.
Really?
You know? Yes, the Coolidges were another big family involved in trading between China and India.
Calvin Coolidge's family?
I think so. I mean, it was a Coolidge family from Massachusetts, and I imagine it must have. I mean, I've not researched Calvin Coolidge's genealogy, but I feel fairly sure. And you know, I was doing one of these radio programs with somebody. With a radio host in Massachusetts, and somebody called in and said that Senator Kerry of Massachusetts, his name is John F. Kerry, and the F stands for Forbes, and the Forbes family was also one of the major trading families in Canton in the 19th century.
Oh, my.
Isn't that extraordinary? Washington Irving, you know, the great American writer, his nephews were trading in Canton. And he himself was speculating, you know. He was writing them letters, sending them money to invest for him in the opium trade.
He's briefly mentioned, too, in the book, isn't he?
Yes, that's right.
The book is River of Smoke, and Amitav Ghosh joins us to talk about it. There's all this increasing pressure because Balaram is there waiting to unload his ship full of opium. It's worth all this money. He's got investors who are waiting back in India to be paid their profit, and the Chinese are cracking down, and all these ships full of opium are out there waiting to be unloaded, and they can't unload them, and Balaram is getting more and more nervous, and the pressure is rising, and you've got this one guy who's kind of a nut, who's willing to take risks, and is it correct to say this guy is a religious nut?
He's a very curious character, James Inn. He's a real character, you know. I mean, and those incidents all really happened. He was an absolutely wild kind of man, and he was, you know, like many of the Canton traders, he was very sort of fervently religious, fervently sort of Protestant, evangelical, and at the same time, he was absolutely fervent believer in the opium trade.
Mm.
He believed that it was, you know, an essential aspect of his freedom, that he should be allowed to trade in opium. So he continued to smuggle, defy the Chinese authorities, and very, very openly. And he played a very major part in precipitating the opium wars.
Well, I just love these books, and I can't wait for the next one.
Well, thank you so much, Vic. It's wonderful to hear that. Thank you.
We've been talking to Amitav Ghosh, and his book is River of Smoke. The first book was called Sea of Poppies, and I'm going to take a wild guess that in the next book we're going to have some war.
I don't know what's going to happen in the next book, to be honest.
Is that one on the horizon?
Well, I haven't been able to make a start on it, but I'll get to it soon.
Well, we'll look forward to that. It'll definitely be worth the wait. And
thank you very much.
Depending upon how that goes, maybe that won't be the last book.
Let's see.
Okay. Well, it's really been a pleasure having you on the program.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been a great pleasure for me, too.
You've been listening to The Book Nook on WYSO. Our guest has been Amitav Ghosh. His book is River of Smoke. For The Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis. Thanks for listening. Here's an excerpt from River of Smoke. And then, above the roar of the storm, he heard a breaking, tearing, splintering sound as if the ship were being torn apart. The ship rolled steeply to starboard, sending both Vico and Balaram sliding down the deck planks. As they lay sprawled in the angle between deck and bulwark, loose balls of opium came cannoning down to crash into the timbers. Each ball was worth a sizable sum of silver, but neither Balaram nor Vico now had any regard for their value. The Anahita was listing at so steep an angle that it seemed all but certain that she would roll over on her beam. And then very slowly the ship began to ease off, with the weight of her keel pulling her back from the brink of tipping over. In righting herself, she rolled again to the other side, and then again, before settling into a precarious balance. The Book Nook is recorded at Soundspace in Yellow Springs and engineered by Chris Hertzler.